You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, Jay Cutler. Started a new podcast called Uncut with Jay Cutler. Most of you know me from the NFL. Some of you have seen me on Instagram. And some of you know me from the reality TV world. Each week I'm taking you along with me as we discuss football, trending topics, and whatever's going on in my life each week. I'm bringing along people that are special in my life. Former teammates, friends, and some new people that I like and respect. That's what you're supposed to do, right? Podcasting? I think I'm doing this right. Can't wait to get started with you. Go subscribe now. Uncut with Jay Cutler. Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, and Spotify. Or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Danny LaRue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Seth Partnow of The Athletic, of Stats Bomb, of his exciting new book, The Mid-Range Theory, which is coming extremely soon, which is super great. And Seth and I talk about the season so far, his excellent piece at The Athletic about the slow offensive start to the season league-wide, why that is happening, what is potentially impactful, what is more just anomalous and everything else. So we go through that. And then the players and teams that have been most interesting to us in the early going, talk about Miami, talk about Chicago, talk about the Knicks, and numerous other teams and players that have interested us in the early part of the season. Lots of great stuff here. Little bit under an hour. Hope you really enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, I wanted to have you on normally, but I thought that it was motivated even more by really good piece that came out for you at The Athletic. I believe that was Wednesday. And basically, it ties in with something that has been... I appreciate your work on this, and it's funny because our collaborative stuff doesn't always lower the temperature, but this, I think, did a really good job of contextualizing the offensive challenges that the NBA has faced kind of collectively over the first 2 weeks of the season.
Yeah, I mean, is it challenges? Is it better defense? Is it fewer free throws because of the rule emphasis? I mean, I don't know. I mean, there has been sort of a multi-stage panic, both league-wide and I think certainly with some individuals about kind of poor shooting starts, but it's like this just is sort of how it works. I think if there's one takeaway from one sort of larger takeaway from that piece, that would be it.
Right. And like the way that I would describe it is you could think about a bell curve, and the things that are really interesting and potentially significant are when you're on the real fringes of that. If you're, you know, still in the bell, but you're, you know, towards one end or the other, then the expectation is that we will see some regression to the mean. And then it's those things that are really extreme. Now, maybe that's just, you know, regression, it needs a more extreme regression, and that absolutely can and will happen. You know, the players who shoot 10% on threes at the beginning of the year probably aren't going to shoot 10% for the whole year. But that to me is what makes one of the stats in the piece is that the ratio of free throw attempts to field goal attempts is the lowest that it has ever been. Like, that is the type of thing where it's like, okay, maybe there is something fundamentally different here, even if it's not as different as it looks at the moment.
Yeah, no, that was the one sort of, that's the one trend early this year that seems to be unusual in terms of what is normally happening, you know, early in the season. Early in the season, turnovers are way up. Shooting, especially from three, is way down. And those two things combine to mean that offensive rating over the first couple weeks of a season is generally around 3 points lower than wherever that the season ends up. And this is true even last year, even like the turbocharged offense we had last year. It started from a higher level. But it still, you know, it started the first couple weeks of the season were something like 108, 109, and then it ended 111. So this year it's 106 instead of 109. So yeah, if the trend holds, offense will be down about 2 points per 100 this year, which isn't, you know, which isn't a massive decline, especially as the data starts to suggest that kind of the fanless environment of the bubble and through most of last year was the real outlier.
Well, and that's such a fascinating salient point, is that we're coming off of two anomalous seasons. Now, for 2020-21, that was a large portion of the season where fans weren't there, and that appears to have been a more favorable environment for shooters. And then 19-20 had the weird stuff where, I would say the first half of the season was quote-unquote normal, even a little bit beyond that, and then you had the bubble and the playoffs and everything else, so it kind of depends what you're trying to build from 19-20. And so reassessing kind of back to before that is useful. And like the league has changed a lot since like 17-18. And like when you did, there's this great chart in the piece that you put out at The Athletic about how the league was through 100 games, roughly where we were, 100 total games, where we were a couple days ago, and the full season averages. It's like, yeah, we're closer in line to 2 years ago. And remember, 2 years ago, the sample we're talking about, that was a quote-unquote normal sample because COVID hadn't happened yet.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. But the one thing that is unusual, again, is as you mentioned, is the free throw rate. But I hope I made this clear in the piece, is even that is you can read that even in sort of a way that fits with the normal trend, because usually the first couple weeks of the season see some really like strong enforcement of the offseason points of emphasis. And most of the time, at least in my memory, most of those things are about calls which they want to be made more. And this year, because of the, you know, the non-basketball moves and stuff like that, the points of education and emphasis are calls that they want to see less. So in a way that and in the past, those things have kind of dropped off. Like there was one year where like we're really going to call traveling this year, and then travels were way up for the first couple of weeks of the season. And then rest of the season, they were just kind of at the normal rate, maybe slightly up, but just kind of basically a normal rate. And if that trend were to hold, I think we would start to see free throw rates start to climb up as players adjust, but also the refs kind of probably get more into their comfort zone as to what is and isn't a foul. Because I think it's just from a visual standpoint, I think there has been some overadjustment to the points of education emphasis. I mean, there's a play that went around Twitter where people were saying, yeah, it's not a foul anymore, James Harden, where I think it was Chris Duarte had like both hands across his chest. And yeah, Harden tried to do like the upwards rip move, but it's still, you've got the guys driving by you and you've got both hands on his chest. That's a foul. Like regardless of whatever else. And it's just, because they're so cognizant of the arm motion that I guess that's why it didn't get called.
Yeah. I think that there are some minor adjustments that are major for a specific player like Harden, because yeah, it looks like the refs are attuned to certain things that I agree with you. Like that Duarte play and a few others, like those are fouls. And I think that another important informational piece here is, I mean, and Tim Bontemps' piece gets to this, is that it appears that overall, not entirely, not every single piece, the league seems happy with where this is. And that the reason that matters is because, you might say that the league, you know, Monty McCutchen and everybody else wouldn't say that they were unhappy with a change, even if they were, just because, you know, except for like that disastrous ball or something like that, where they had to make a change. But I think what it indicates to me, and when you think about, like, I mean, it seems like the fan response has been good, and that was a part of Bontemps' piece. It wasn't just talking to, like, Monty McCutchen. It was, you know, league office people, Evan Wash, and various other things. And so what I think that does is it gives referees an indication, which, of course, they're getting from the league office and non-public communications, that this is closer to the way that they want the game called. And I agree with that. I think that the league is on the right track. They're not all the way there, but they're on the right track. And so, yes, I believe, like you do, that there will be an adjustment and that this will that there will be more fouls called and they will change some of it. But I also don't think that this is going to be the full call traveling, call crab dribbles and whatever for 2 weeks and then go back. I don't think it's that way, in part because this is more of an interpretation thing, and in part because it kind of makes it, like, I think as an it is more of an overall ethos thing where referees can stay more engaged with it than some of the other tweaks that have been done in the past.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But I also, I mean, I think the sort of the statistical impact will start to become muted as players sort of start to adjust. I mean, you think about there's times where players have tried like the pump fake and lean in, and then like, oh, the whistle didn't blow, I got to pass out of it, and they've just burned 4 seconds on the shot clock. If they play basketball for those 4 seconds instead, you know, some of those times are going to end up in fouls. Some of those times are going to end up in just better possessions. So like the you know, to the extent that the looser, the more leeway allowed to defenders has led to a decline in offense, I think as players start to adjust, they'll kind of claw some of that decline back.
Yeah, I totally
still settling at a lower equilibrium than, you know, last year. I think, you know, I'm generally not I kind of generally take the league meta as at where it is, but I sort of thought that even last year was, you know, too pro offense. And dialing it back some is good. There, it hasn't been done necessarily in the particular way that I would have, but it certainly has helped.
Well, and along the lines of what you're talking about of the adjustments, I mean, two things. One, like another reform that I would like to see, the abolition of Euro fouls, intentional fouls, to stop fast breaks, the overall intention of the Competition Committee League Office's rule changes here is not to call these sorts of things less often. It's to not have them happen in the first place. And I thought that, you know, Nate and I recently, we were doing this podcast on players who, you know, are struggling to start the season, and we're trying to kind of figure out what will persist and what will not. And one of the things that we noticed is that Harden is shooting a lot less efficiently on kind of like floater range shots. And something when we watched some of the film on it that we noticed is part of the reason why is he's doing things that he thinks are going to be shooting fouls. And then, you know, the field goal doesn't really matter. You know, if it goes in, great. But if it doesn't, then does it count against your percentages? But he's not getting the call. And so some of those become, as we used to refer to it to Chris Paul, like throwing up some crap, you know, like those sorts of plays. And eventually the end game is not for Harden to get those calls necessarily, though I agree with you that some of them should. It's for some of those shots to just not exist. And so you'll actually get more efficient by not taking the bait shot. You know, that might be one way of putting it. And I also think free throw attempt rates will go up a little bit. And I also think that the other adjustment, and we've, you know, this hasn't been as extreme. Like, we're seeing guys like Giannis and Jokic, their free throw attempt rates have not gone down in the way these perimeter players have, is that I think there's been a little too much of refs saying, oh, we're letting a lot more go now. So, like, players are getting, I think, hit around the basket a lot harder, and there aren't fouls right now. And those are fouls. Like, and I think that is one element. You know, it's the league doesn't have to be a monolith. They don't have to be a single thing where it's like fewer fouls or anything like that. They can say, okay, these ones need to be tweaked in this way, these ones need to be tweaked in that way. And that's why they maintain communication with officials.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So we can move on kind of to thinking about, you know, again, we're 2 weeks in. I've think back to the overreactionizer, and you and I are both, I would say in some ways we're both attuned to not doing that. But we do have, you know, seven.
When Cade Cunningham is a bust.
Oh, boy. I mean, I do want to go. I want to wait a couple more games. It might be for 8-9, 15-60. And I want to look at his shooting form compared to Summer League, because it did look a little bit different in the Bucks game. That's something I want to keep an eye on. But no, I agree with you there.
Playing on a bad ankle, getting back into shape.
And he's only played in two games. Like, you know, it's not even like, we're not even dealing with like an 8-game sample with Cade Cunningham. We're talking about two games right after a month out, which is a while for him.
So he's actually, it's funny, he's getting a little bit of the R.J. Barrett. You know, when R.J. Barrett was a rookie, he was like, everyone talked about him at Duke. I can't wait to see R.J. Barrett with NBA spacing. And then he got to the Knicks, and after his first year with the Knicks, I can't wait to see R.J. Barrett with NBA spacing. It's, you know, last year at Oklahoma State, we're like, man, when Cade has some talents around him, can't wait. And now he's playing on a Pistons team that, you know, man, when he has some talent around him, it's going to be great still.
I mean, it is a reminder of the frustration, and I understand for competitive balance reasons, though I've argued for the abolition of the draft before and stand by that, that the best players typically go to bad teams. And that means it's going to take a little while for them to do it. And that's why the, and I mean, lottery reform was a part of this. The Ja Morant going to the Grizzlies, who had a little bit, I would say they had a stronger foundation than like the absolute dregs, has led to them coming out of the wilderness, not only earlier, but stronger than some teams getting a top two pick would.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, they've also, I mean, I think Memphis also deserves credit for nailing a lot of like the marginal moves as well. Like, you know, picking up a D'Anthony Melton for free, basically, that seems like it's been a useful thing for them.
Yeah, I think overall there's an interesting parallel with the Grizzlies and their trade partner in the Melton trade, the Suns, where they've done a lot of things. Like, by and large, the decisions the front office has made, Zach Kleiman, the front office, and then James Jones and the Suns, have been very good, including many that I disagreed with at the time. For the Suns, that was the Melton trade. For the Grizzlies, it absolutely was not, because that was to save Robert Sarver money. And but the interesting parallel with those two front offices,
at least they used this money savings on extending DeAndre. Oh wait, no, that didn't happen. They used it on extending Landry Shamet, which is the, oh boy,
hooray.
Yeah.
but the parallel between those two is that both Jones and Kleiman have been very comfortable, to use kind of a Danny Ainge analogy, betting on their board, where they've like sacrificed more to get something that they thought was going to be right, whether that's, you know, using more draft equity for somebody like Cam Johnson or Jalen Smith, or in Kleiman's case, like that's in some ways what the Justice Winslow trade was, where it was that they identified, this is the type of player that we need, and I thought they gave up too much, not in the way of resources, but in the way of assets, but in the way of like taking on all the salary, including guys that they waived, like Deion Waiters, almost immediately. And so what I think that the overall picture is very good, and there's like it's
I'm going to push back a little there,
sure,
just because like I think that the most of what Kleiman has done has been really good. That trade was bad from the off.
Oh, I agree.
Betting on your board, whatever. Like, even if you're betting on your board, that's a bad trade. Like, that's
and I think you'll echo this, is that happened in the Grizzlies trade, was that I don't think they understood the leverage they had. Where basically, right, the Heat got everything they wanted, mm-hmm, the Grizzlies got something they wanted, and there was no other way for the Heat to get everything they wanted. So at that point, you can take on less bad money. Maybe you can't really get much in the way of draft assets from the Heat because they basically never have them. But yeah, I agree with you. It was a poor use of leverage, I would say, is my criticism there. But overall, you're right. I mean, they brought in the right coach with Taylor Jenkins. The Grizzlies also have done something that I love, which is there is no rule that you have to start training camp with only 15 guaranteed contracts. And so if you have 16, 17 guys and you're not sure, you know, you're under the cap, the tax, whatever it's going to be, and you're not sure who your 14th and 15th roster spots should belong to, bring them all in. There is no obligation to clean that all up beforehand. It might cost a little bit extra money, but if it's not going to affect your kind of spending capacity, by all means.
I feel like Daryl used to do this in Houston.
Yeah.
Under previous ownership, obviously, but they would come to camp with, and the Celtics too, I think, would occasionally come to camp with 16, 17 guys guaranteed. And then like, okay, sort of let them fight and see who earns the spot.
Well, and there was also the latitude for both of those teams, as I remember it, for bringing in, you know, you fill out to 20 or whatever, and then if the guaranteed guys aren't as good, then, you know, the Rade Zagoriches of the world, then they get cut and you can keep the non-guaranteed guys. And there are some teams where it kind of feels like a fait accompli that the guys that are guaranteed are going to make it even if it's outperformed. And so I think that it's another piece of latitude.
You got to talk about Alan Smilagic like that.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Well, I will say this. The Jordan Poole pick, even though he has been very, very up and down to start this year, like there was at one point, there was this run of like Warriors picks where it just seemed like everybody wasn't working out. And yes, Jordan Poole was taken immediately over Keldon Johnson, who I think is a superior player as of now. And we'll see how their careers turn out. But yeah,
Go ahead. I don't totally get Keldon Johnson. Like, I don't know. I don't totally get it there. Like, Jordan Poole was not a player I loved in the draft. In fact, quite the opposite. But I mean, it's easier for me to see Jordan Poole becoming a guy on, whereas Keldon Johnson is, a positive piece on a, you know, a contending level team. And there's a lot more just a guy about Keldon Johnson to me. Like, he's, you know, kind of almost profiles as like a slightly worse Jeff Green.
Well, it's a reminder. I think Nate is the person you can try to remember who to give credit to for this, of the, like, somebody who is more of a 3-and-D, and I mean that more in terms of a lower usage player, not necessarily like, yeah, Keldon Johnson's a great 3-point shooter. The problem with 3-and-D guys is that it for a lot of them, one or both are tenuous. You know, like, yeah, either the 3-point shot isn't all the way there, and like Keldon Johnson, career 34% 3-point shooter, currently 14% as we record this podcast, is that you have to be good on defense. And Johnson, it appears from like him making the Olympic team and all that, that his work ethic is good. But I agree with you that the kind of capacity for a higher role within the offense is really valuable. But like for the Warriors going back there, like there was this point where they're, you know, taking Jacob Evans, and you know, they didn't draft Amari Spellman, but they brought him in, and then he was gone pretty quickly. And Smile Geach, where it's like, oh geez, they're really, and like one of the guys who looked like he was going to work was Eric Paschal, who they then dumped for nothing. And then so Poole looking like a viable NBA player, albeit starting right now, we'll have to see. That's more of a you know, situational thing because Clay is unavailable. So yeah, I think that can work out. Let's get to so the way I described this, I had Nekias Duncan on last week, was kind of teams that have defied your expectations. Like, who has interested you so far? We're dealing with small sample size. We're not saying that Team X is what they are, is what they're going to be moving forward. But like, kind of who has intrigued you so far? I can start with one if you want to think about it.
Yeah, please go ahead.
There is definitely some regression that is going to happen, but Miami's offense, like, that was my big thing, and I'm still concerned about it from a playoff perspective because, you know, some of this is going to tone down, and I mean, generally speaking, transition offense gets worse in the playoffs because teams actually get the hell back. It's part of the whole thing. But the health of their offense, the ball movement has been better. Adding Kyle Lowry has worked. And yes, I do not think that Miami is going to end the season with the number one offense in the league. But their defense is good. I expected that to be there. And so I, you know, the way I would have described it before the year was, I could see the possibility, but I didn't expect it to happen. And now I would say it's way more reasonable than I expected before.
I mean, my biggest issue with the Heat was always, okay, I see what the theory is here, but how do they make sure they can actualize this in May? And, you know, they haven't, you know, some other teams have been beaten with the injury stick pretty hard, and the Heat have avoided that so far. But we're 2 weeks into the season. So, you know, come back to me in 5 months and see if Jimmy Butler misses games in the last couple of years, Kyle Lowry misses games, Bam Adebayo misses games, you know, PJ Tucker is old. Like, and, you know, you start to take one or more of those guys off the roster. Like, we've seen kind of what the soft underbelly of the Bucks roster looks like, more than we had expected early in the season. I think, you know, the Heat, you're going to see the same thing. So yeah, with their team in place, they are a very good team. Now, how much of that very goodness is Tyler Hero shooting approximately 173% on jumpers? You know, does that sustain? You know, weirder things have happened, but at the same time, you know, weird things happen less frequently than more normal things do. So, No, but yeah, I mean, you can't have asked for more from them, but it's just, you know, it's sort of the pump the brakes. They haven't answered, like, 2 weeks isn't enough time to answer the longevity question either way. So, you know, you can't ding them for having not answered that, but you can't credit them for having answered it in the positive either, just because, you know, they've played, what, 7 games?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way of putting it. I'm not ready to fully discuss it yet, but it is interesting. I'm not going to say significant like it's going to continue. The New York Knicks are fourth in half-court offense this year, and part of that is they're not missing any threes whatsoever. They're currently top of the league. But it's, you know, I think part of that is they're, you know, they have better shooting. They have better spacing this year. And
they have four guys who can do things with the ball in their starting lineup. I think that's
and enough off their bench, too.
Yeah.
Like that's
like I think obviously Kemba Walker has been just a massive impact there. And I think that even though he has never been a particularly effective playoff player, like Evan Fournier has been just not quite as big, but a huge upgrade over, at least offensively, over Reggie Bullock, just with his ability to shoot on the move and his ability to make plays off the dribble when he gets, you know, players run at him. So that gives them, you know, four different guys who can do things to break defenses down. And, you know, at times, like at times, the player who is almost has struggled to create like separation and has relied on tough shot making has been Randall. But still, that's just so many more ways that they can just get quality offensive possessions than they had last year, where, you know, we were all left with the memories of the playoff series where it was, you know, Randall kind of battering his head against, you know, a very set Atlanta defense and them playing every possession against the shot clock and hoping Derrick Rose hit enough pull-ups to keep them in games.
Right. And I think one of the most telling stats from the Knicks season so far is that they're, you know, I brought up their fourth, I believe, in half court offense and their third overall per cleaning the glass. They're doing that while Julius Randle has 53% true shooting. And it's because they're having more ways to attack, having a more versatile offense. Part of what it does is it sometimes puts other players in better situations to succeed. That was part of why I was optimistic about Randle this year. And, you know, we're 8 games in. I'm not freaking out or anything too crazy with that. But the other part is that if something doesn't work, whether it's because that guy's just not having a good game or because the other team is structuring things to make life harder on that player, you know, shifting extra coverage, everything like that, whatever defensive scheme they're using, you have other things to go to. And I think, you know, you brought up Fournier and Kemba is, of course, extremely important in this, is that, okay, if Julius Randle doesn't have it or the team is doing something there, then you're not wedded to that. And I think that's really positive for the Knicks. And I, you know, I'm still not sure how, you know, the idea, I think you and I don't know if we talked about it in the podcast. I know we talked about it in other spaces individually and together, that like there was this idea that the Knicks, basically that the Knicks improved their roster and improved their structure to the point where like, they might land where they did last year, because last year was anomalous for a couple of different reasons. And like, they might end up being a little bit better than that. But I think that especially the offense has been crazy so far, but that it makes them a much more viable playoff team, which I think, I don't know how Dolan and Leon Rose are defining success, but I think it's an important way to do it when your team already has made the playoffs.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that like last year was very positive and then ended very ugly because as we've both said, like they ran smack into their kind of limitations from a creativity on offense, almost creativity on both sides of the ball standpoint, and the limitations of the roster. And I think that they did some really good things to upgrade that. Now, you know, how deep does Kemba Walker get you into the playoffs? Does he get you into the second round? Yeah, in the right matchup he does. And then, you know, you get to a high enough level and his own kind of defensive foibles and just, you know, the fact that he's tiny sort of comes into play more. But, you know, I don't think they entered this season thinking that they were a title contender. Do you think so? Do you think they did?
I don't think so. I think the idea to me was that it made it more likely for them to win a first round series, and then each one after that gets harder. And it is true that the top of the East, Miami notwithstanding, is, you know, I mean, on paper, I mean, the full strength Nets were going to be nasty. We haven't seen that at all. Who knows if we're going to at all this year. But I have been thinking a lot over the offseason and then into the season about this idea, and you could argue both Milwaukee and Phoenix fit this, where, and if you want to go back to Toronto's championship or numerous other ones, is that I think front offices now are much more comfortable. Basically, like, there's this group of, like, viable teams where it's like there is a path for them to be in the mix. And you can make an argument that in most years, the team that wins the championship is the healthiest team that fits that criteria. Do I think the Knicks fit that criteria? No. Do I think they got closer to it? You bet.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that there's, you know, you start to make that list and it's just, you know, who passes that post. And it's at this point, you know, we started the season thinking it was the Lakers, Nets, and Bucks. And, you know, the Heat are kind of knocking on that door. Utah's probably going to have another regular season where we're like, maybe this year. And maybe it will be. Like, maybe they will.
Maybe they added perimeter defenders. Oh, wait.
Okay. Well, no, not that then. Well, no, but maybe Mike Conley is healthy in the playoffs this year.
Yeah, and maybe their offense is good enough that having these defensive flaws is survivable.
Yeah, part of that is they also didn't, partially because of injury, really take their regular season offense with them into the playoffs, and you know, we turning Bogdanovich and Ingles into standstill shooters is kind of like, well, what's the point of having these kind of defensive the defensive problems that front court gives us if we're not going to take advantage of their offense? But that's, you know, neither here nor there. And that's probably all the most both of us have talked about the Jazz all year so far, because the Jazz are, I think Zach Lowe said it this way, is like, kind of wake me up in the playoffs. And they're kind of the team that's in that sort of like, okay, they're going to win a ton of regular season games and nothing they can do really changes my opinion of them until we see like different outcomes in the postseason.
Well, yeah. And I remember Jazz partisans talking to me last time about like, well, why did you care so much more about the game because they had these two games against the Clippers last year. And if memory serves, one of them, the Clippers were like, had more of their guys, and one, the Clippers had fewer. Like, why did you talk about the game where the Jazz lost instead of the game where they won? It's like, because I think it's a more representative sample. And that was the game, you know, and it ended up being that the Jazz lost to the even shorter-handed Clippers in the playoffs. And part of it also for the Jazz is the nature of the season. Like, they've had a number of games so far against less competitive teams. Like, they played OKC, they played Houston, they played the Bucks when they were extremely shorthanded. And, like, Utah is the best suited team in the entire league to steamrolling weak opposition. Like, that is, you know, and so the
them are the full strength Bucks, I would say.
Yes,
are the
yes.
two teams that are best set up to kind of,
yeah, I mean, and for anybody who watched Bucks Pistons, which Nate and I did because we wanted to watch Cade Cunningham, like, it was a tour de force. And even though the Bucks were shorthanded, of how that happens, because Giannis was incredible in that game. And also the Pistons, like, they if you can't shoot, you're probably not going to get much around the basket if Giannis is playing. And so, yeah, that was also there, but they've been so shorthanded. I'm happy you brought them up, though. They are the other team there, and that's part of why both teams have put up great regular season records for multiple years, and why they have really strong like net ratings and all that, is because they are consistently effective in those games. And like, as we're recording this, the Jazz are 6-1, and their only loss was to the Bulls.
Let's talk about the Bulls.
Okay.
No, I like, you know, it's that sort of, I think that we were both in agreement in not liking the DeRozan move. Do you feel any different about that now?
Somewhat. I think DeRozan has been better than I anticipated. Some of the challenges of too many cooks haven't really mattered that much, but I'm still not there on their defense. I mean, that is the, you know, the biggest reason that I criticized it was more the opportunity cost, that basically they gave up a ton, not only in terms of draft resources to get Vooch and to get DeRozan, but also in terms of financial flexibility. Maybe Zach LaVine said, like, I'm not extending anyway, so you can spend all this. They, you know, they brought in all this stuff to make it work financially. But my idea was basically they're this limited team, and it wouldn't be a surprise for me to see Chicago as a far more dangerous regular season team than they are a playoff team. And it's worth noting, though, like, at the moment, they are fourth in Clean the Glass's defensive metric, and it's not like it's insane opponent shooting luck. Like, their opponents aren't making a ton around the basket, but generally teams can control that more. That said, they've played... Yes. That said, let's just say they've played some weak offensive opposition in the aggregate. Yeah,
and you know... Like, what's the mechanism by which the Bulls are holding down opponent rim percentage? Like, that's sort of where is that coming from? Like, you know, Vooch is okay because he's large and in the way, and that gets you to a certain degree, but he's not any sort of, you know, elite rim protector. Certainly once, like, Patrick Williams went down, like, then it's not like they have another one. Like, is you know, the couple minutes that Derek Jones is getting, is he, and they don't have, it's not like they're getting, you know, a ton from, like, their most effective rim protector, help side rim protector, is probably Lonzo, right? Mm-hmm. And by the way, I think he and Caruso have been great for them, and that's part of it too. Like, DeRozan's been good, but also they've gotten everything that they could have reasonably expected from Lonzo and Caruso so far as well.
And I would say they've gotten more from Tony Bradley too.
Yeah, no, I thought Tony Bradley was a perfectly, you know, Tony Bradley, Derek Jones were perfectly reasonable signings, and you know, getting something from them has helped.
Well, yeah, and you can see, like, it's been interesting for me with Caruso that you have this duality, and it's like he makes a big difference, and you could see the difference in the Bulls defense, but you could also see that Caruso, you know, like, I don't think he's particularly scalable offensively. You know, he's not going to be a high usage guy, so it's like, can you use that player? Yes, obviously, absolutely. And Caruso, he's making more of his twos this year, which is, you know, preliminarily, you know, 200 minutes in is leading to him being more efficient overall. It's just Billy Donovan, you have to use a player like that in a very specific circumstance. And I think that so far he has. And with part of the benefit of having LaVine and DeRozan on the same roster is that you can have 48 minutes where you have a credible creator, and both of those guys not being point guard sized means that you can use players like Caruso and, to an extent, Lonzo Ball more reliably, because you don't need them to do the parts of offense that they're not particularly good at.
Yep. No, and I think that's why, you know, LaVine being able to do that is why we liked the additions of both of them for the Bulls. And I think maybe the part where we missed out on, and I don't think we missed out on this, I think as you rightly pointed out, as much about the opportunity cost, because we thought that the DeRozan move made them better. It just was the juice worth the squeeze. But you know, basically taking any creation responsibilities whatsoever off of Caruso's plate, and like, okay, finish alley oops and then transition and stick an open three here and there, and then just be, you know, one of the best two or three point of attack defenders in the league. That's what we're going to ask you to do. And, you know, it's a very useful player. And that's sort of what they've been able to get out of him, because they're not asking him to do things he can't do.
Exactly. And I already think that the Lakers will regret basically seeing Caruso. It's hard to know for sure whether the reason the Lakers did not retain Caruso, and it seems like basically just let him go, even though Caruso was unrestricted and had more of a voice in the process, is that they didn't want that kind of overall bill, or is it because they didn't think that he specifically was worth it? Like, that's something that I'm leaning more towards the latter, especially when the Lakers ended up, you know, spending what they did on Talen Horton-Tucker. And it would not surprise me in the least if, when it comes to May, as flawed as Caruso is, you know, it's a point guard-sized guy who isn't reliable at creating offense for himself or others, You know who else doesn't need that? The Lakers.
Yeah. No, that's right. Trying to put yourself in the thought process of someone who thought that looked at that team and said, you know what this needs is Russell Westbrook. Like, okay, well, does Westbrook and Caruso work together? No. Okay. Well, so Horton Tucker is if we're going to have one of those, that's the one we go. Now, I think both of us would have been in the camp of, hey, why not just, you know, get Buddy Hield or get a shooter, get some more of the thing that we know works around LeBron and AD rather than, you know, trading all of your fungible assets for Russell Westbrook. But, you know, that ship has sailed.
Well, and also along the lines of fungible assets is I think they're missing Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, and they're missing like a lot of like those, you know, having players. And yes,
could they use the Kyle Kuzma that Washington's getting?
Yeah. And even though Kuzma
who
was
couldn't, by the way, but
what?
Who couldn't use the Kuzma that Washington's getting, but you know, it's he's been good. Like,
yeah,
he's turned himself into a very, very functional, like the higher end role player.
Yeah. And even though Kuzma's shot isn't falling to the degree that we expect, he's become more capable defensively. And that was, you know, the Lakers helped with a lot of that. And he, you know, being Kuzma being a part of an overall picture is something that we didn't, you know, there were times early in his career where you're like, oh, that's just not going to happen. And I mean, I would say that's been a part of it for the Wizards so far.
Yeah, no, part of it is, you know, a guy, you see this a fair amount. A guy comes in, gets some hype for some reason, and to some degree buys his own hype and is like, I'm going to be this ball in hand star. And then, okay, maybe that's not me. And then some guys like are always trying to be that. And those are the guys who sort of, you know, tantalize and end up on, you know, the second best player on mediocre teams a lot. And then there's the guys like, okay, well, I guess I'm not that. So I'll just be a really good player who does other things. It seems like Kuzma's made that choice and too much to his benefit.
And that is also, you know, we talked earlier about Cade Cunningham, the RJ Barrett stuff of like, oh, they go to a team. It's like some of the times those players get that in their heads because their flawed team at the moment they come in needs somebody like that. And then but they're not good enough to be that player on a better team. And so, you know, bring in LeBron James and all of a sudden Kyle Kuzma's role changes.
Right.
One of the other things that sometimes you can take away over a small sample, 2 weeks and everything like that, is what I would say is the case for Miles Bridges, which is basically this, you know, player comes in, and I mean, I have the benefit of I saw him in person on Wednesday night, and you're just like, oh, he's just a better basketball player. And that is something that can happen too. Will he necessarily have this, you know, this usage, this role within the Hornets offense and also make threes at this kind of volume and success rate? Not totally sure on that, but I am confident that Bridges has more of the connective tissue, has a better all-around game this year than I saw from him last year, and that most of that, if not probably not all of it, will continue moving forward.
Yeah, this is I think with Bridges' situation where like a small improvement in one part of a player's game unlocks other things. I know you and I think you and Nate have talked about this a lot where one of the big examples is like once Giannis kind of got a little stronger and grew into his body, all of a sudden like his athleticism just like sprouted. With Bridges, I think he was a guy I really liked coming in part because I thought he profiled as a decent playmaker. Now, his handle his ball handling was suspect for his first couple of years in the league to the point where he couldn't really access kind of that vision and decision making ability. And, you know, he's never going to be a ball handling wizard, but it has improved functionally enough to the point where he can make a play off the dribble, whether for himself or for teammates. And that's the kind of thing that allows him to, you know, use his shooting ability and his athleticism to be a more central offensive player. And so I think I think that's the growth we're seeing. Would you agree with that?
I would. And I love the way that you put that, because it is so important to think of player development as being a lot of different things that you might sometimes see at the same time. And I was talking with Nikias last week, and he brought up that he saw more of this from Bridges last year than I did. And like he watched more of the Hornets because, you know, he's kind of more located in the area and everything else, and also watched, which is crazy because I watched a lot of the Hornets too. But that I didn't see the kind of the inklings then you saw it with him at Michigan State. I don't believe I watch any Miles Bridges films. I think that was a year that Nate and I didn't get to watch much. But he, yeah, I mean, there's a lot more that makes sense there. And I mean, you see that with players also at different points of their career. Well, also they get the confidence, and at times the Hornets needed somebody who could do that. And once Bridges established his capacity for it, particularly in the lineups where LaMelo and Gordon Hayward aren't both out there, which is a fair portion of the game, they try to stagger those guys reasonably. And having a wing-sized guy who can make good decisions and who also, like Bridges, he played with force, but in kind of specific ways. And that, like, I think that's becoming more all around now. And a lot of that, I think, is the confidence in his handle, where it's like, okay, I can, not only can I just dunk this really hard, which I've been able to do the whole time, but I can get by this guy, I can get a shoulder there, and then I can finish or dunk really hard or make the right pass.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. Like using his, again, that's unlocking his ability to sort of use that physicality. Like he doesn't have to, because of that frame, he doesn't have to be, you know, have the most intricate, tightest handle to get places. It just has to be good enough that it doesn't get picked. It doesn't like slow him down. He just, okay, well, I got my shoulder into you, and now I'm going to elevate over you for, you know, a little, you know, 4 foot floater, and there's nothing you can do about it because, you know, my shoulders are 8 feet wide and I'm jumping 40 inches.
Yeah, I think that's great. Any other teams, players, situations you want to discuss? We're right at there, so I'll leave it to you. If there's anything you really want to discuss, we can. Otherwise, we can not.
You know, I just want to, like, there's just a reminder that Masai Ujiri is good at his job.
Yeah.
You look at what, you know, what Scottie Barnes has done so far and what Jalen Suggs has done so far. And we don't want to, you know, draw too many conclusions. Like if I'm going to, you know, defend Cade Cunningham, a player I liked coming in, it's probably churlish of me to point to shooting percentage for Suggs, who I was probably lower on than consensus. But you like, okay, that people, that was a very surprising pick when it was made to kind of the broader populace. And it, you know, at very minimum, I think we've at least seen enough to understand what Ujiri saw there, right? Even if it doesn't necessarily work out that way in the long term, I think that like, if it turns out to be a mistake, it's a pretty easily justifiable mistake at this point.
Yeah, and I was lower on Barnes just because the idea of, like, what was his ideal role in a successful offense. But it is wholly unsurprising, both because of Barnes' individual capacity and also the Raptors' coaching and personnel, that he fit in so seamlessly defensively. And so it is kind of interesting that we're just fine. Like, I want to take a second to appreciate that Scottie Barnes being as useful and impactful for the Raptors defensively when he's been available. Like, we shouldn't take that for granted for a rookie just because we expected Scottie Barnes to be unusually impactful for a deep rookie defensively.
Right. Although it's just thinking about that, like, you know, just thinking about this Raptors team and then thinking about, like, you know, Suggs went to Orlando. It's like, wow, they got like Scott, like a Barnes and Siakam and Chris Boucher and Delano Banton. And it's just like, it's a lot of John Hammond guys.
That's true.
You know,
it's so many John Hammond guys.
Yeah. It's just fun to think about.
Well, and the bet in some ways that Toronto is making is that you can correct. It's such an interesting thing that you can improve what those types of players don't do well better than other NBA teams can, and that is more improvable than some of the other flaws, because nobody's perfect. And
you can't teach 6'9 with 7-plus wingspan.
You can. And also, go to some of the growth that OG Anunoby has showed over the last couple of years. And I mean, I was really, really into OG as a prospect. And it was mostly because I believed in the defense right away. And I thought that there was enough other possibilities that he could become a capable offensive player, and there are definitely signs. I mean, he's had some good games and some really bad ones so far, but the reason that you make a bunch of bets on 6'7" to 6'9" guys is because A, they're viable players, even if they're not perfect, and B, some of them, especially if you're good on player development, will improve enough that they become something that is incredibly hard to get any other way.
Yep. No, that's right. But we also have to acknowledge that, like, Toronto's development has not just been in the you know, the gangly, you know, obviously.
Oh, for
like
sure.
Fred VanVleet was undrafted. Like, you know, he turned into one of kind of the very good, like, shooters in the league and very kind of a worthy successor to Kyle Lowry in that role, you know, doing many of the same things, maybe not with quite the, cause he's not quite as big, maybe not quite the force that Lowry, could play with in his prime, but still, they've been a fun team so far.
Yeah. And for the Raptors, the kind of the lingering question for me was, can they get enough, you know, to survive their offensive limitations? And I would say so far the answer has been yes. Like, Toronto 25th in half court offense, but number two in playing the least in the half court. So, okay. I mean, it's not always going to work the way it did in that crazy Celtics game where they turned him over seemingly a billion times and got a bunch of runouts, but the Raptors being that team. Now, that does lend itself to a really interesting question, which is, how does Ujiri feel about this? Is it okay, Pascal Siakam is going to be back in the next 2 weeks, and they still have a lot of time between now and the trade deadline, so you can get a much better sense of what this team is. But if they're in the mix for the playoffs, but probably not going to win a series, like, some teams think that's a great place to be. Some teams are less interested in that. And I think they're in a better spot overall right now, partially because they're not playing in Tampa in the season from hell. They're in a better spot right now than they probably were, you know, a year ago.
Bold statement. Toronto is a better place to live than Tampa.
Well, no, I mean, just as a franchise. Like, I mean, even
yeah,
having
I don't,
a,
no,
like,
I, all, I, don't, all, no, I think that we can go so far as to say describe that as objective fact.
Well, for me, I've never been to Toronto, so it's harder for me to say. I have been to Tampa though. But I think
which should
that
be enough.
Should be. But I think that there is this lingering question. I've been dealing with this, you know, kind of for the last year since the kind of weird trade deadline they had. Of Toronto is full of these players that I think would be really good pieces on a great team, and that great teams should value. But like, Fred VanVleet is a fantastic example of that. You know, he's not the greatest one-on-one creator, but he's a versatile defender, can hit shots. And so, you know, I brought up the Lakers as an example of various other places. And some of their, you know, OG is that. Siakam is different, but and he's also making a lot more money. But so, like, could that lead Masai Ujiri to go in a completely different direction and move some of the guys? Maybe, but I'm also not sure. And, like, it is a judgment call, just like it was a judgment call last year and in the offseason, and I don't know what he's going to do.
Well, I mean, he's someone who is, you know, you mentioned earlier about the willingness to go into camp with decisions to make. He's also not someone who's shown that he's not going to be rushed. So it's like, yeah, no, let's let it play out and see what we need. And then when the time comes to make the next move, we'll make the next move. And you know, I've made those decisions well for my entire career. So I'm confident I will continue to do so. So I'm not going to like, you know, make a decision before I have to.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on.
Absolutely.
Thanks again to Seth Partnow for taking the time to come on. You can read his work at The Athletic. And if you have not already, please pre-order his book, The Mid-Range Theory. We didn't talk about it at all during this. I've only read part of it so far. There was a part of it, actually. I was asking Seth a question, and he's like, actually, I wrote a chapter on this in my book. And so I got it then, and it was excellent. Really enjoyed it. And hopefully I'm going to read it soon. Presumably we will talk about it at some point in this space as well, but you can do that wherever books are sold. You can also, of course, if you don't already, follow him on Twitter at SethPartnow. Love having Seth on, and I enjoy this part of the season. I've mentioned many times that I consider learning and exploration my favorite parts of watching sports, especially basketball, and we're still knee-deep in that, but that does lead you to sometimes overreact and sometimes overstate, and it's interesting in this year where some of it has been struggles, and so how do you do that? Nate and I have done a series of pods and kind of stars that are struggling and what we think of as real and what we think of as not. And there, of course, will be team things. And some of it is also not getting drawn into the early kind of take fest just because the sample is going to get much larger and there's no real benefit to going too early. We're going to learn a lot more. And it's not like me saying this team is great or this team is bad is going to make them any greater or worse. So no reason to go too crazy too early. If you want to support the show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode. That is particularly great for Real GM Radio because it will never come out on a specific day of the week. It's just my availability and guest availability. So that's just the way things are going to go. So it'll just pop into your player, whenever it's there. Can also help other people fund the show through word of mouth or by leaving a rating, leaving a review in the podcast player of your choosing, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, really wherever. Really do appreciate that. You can also check out my other work. Have a piece coming out at The Athletic. Looks like it's going to be Friday, talking about the team-by-team projections of the 2022 salary cap. It's something that I've been working on for a while, and it's kind of shocking, honestly, to where the league landscape is going to be. I'll let you read that at The Athletic when it comes out. And then Dunked On Prime, Dunked On Free with Nate, you know, those are still going strong. One time a week public, actually two because of the Twitter Spaces gets released as a podcast, and then four for Dunked On Prime, and if you're Total Access, Discord chats and everything else. So can check all of that out. And then the NBA cast, Nate and I are doing that Mondays for basically this whole year. And the coming Monday is going to be Hawks at Warriors, which is going to be absolutely awesome. We're super duper excited about it. So that'll be a 7 Pacific, 10 Eastern tip time. And you can join us on League Pass, which is extremely exciting. And if you have any feedback on the show, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. I will try to reply. I admit I'm not the greatest at that, but I will read it. That is something that is exceedingly important to me. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.
Celebrate Heart Healthy Month at ShopRite.
Find heart healthy favorites in-store or online at unbeatable prices.
And go to ShopRite.com/well every day to discover wellness experts, meal inspirations, and trends.
Shop nutritious.
Shop delicious.
Shop wellness.
ShopRite.
Whenever you look for news, you may feel forced to choose between partisans in mainstream media and conspiracists in alternative media.
That's where the Lost Debate steps in.
I'm Corey Bradford, a progressive political organizer turned TikTok star who also once hosted a Fox News radio show.
I'm Ricky Schlatt, a Gen Z New York Post columnist and libertarian fighting to protect free speech.
And I'm Ravi Gupta, a former staffer for Obama and school principal who also fought alongside Republicans on charter schools. And we launched The Lost Debate, a podcast and YouTube show for the political eclectics who've lost trust in a polarizing partisan world, but who also reject the disinformation and manipulation in alternative media.
Instead of being at each other's throats, we focus on bringing new perspectives to the table in constructive debate that sounds less like crossfire and more like discussions between real people.
Check out The Lost Debate on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts.